Welcome to the Leadership Labs with DeepRec.ai, a podcast where we delve into the fascinating world of deep tech entrepreneurship, company founders, and venture capitalists. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly, and I'm thrilled to have you join us on this exciting journey. In each episode, we explore the minds behind groundbreaking technologies, the visionaries who dare to push the boundaries of innovation, and the investors who fuel the growth of tomorrow's game changers.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome Jonathan Balder to the show. Jonathan, great to have you. Jonathan's the co-founder of ZTO at Atos Robotics. In this episode, you'll tell us a little bit about Atos, what they do, talk about, you know, what it was like deciding founder's roles in a business. You seem to be part of a very interesting group called Future CTO. You know, really good to get some insight into this, which talks about performance management, leadership, and then I think an area we're always interested in hearing about is, you know, people's personal upskilling. Where has Jonathan developed in the last several years that he sees himself now versus when he started? But look, before we get into anything, Jonathan, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me, Anthony. It's a real pleasure.
Nice. You've got some time away now, working remotely from the beaches in North Holland.
Yes, absolutely. That's one of the perks of being a founder. In particular, being a founder in the IT industry, where, you know, you can work remotely from anywhere you want, and so I'm actually taking that liberty. And talking to you from here, from Northern Holland today, while my family is spending quality time at the beach.
I'm sorry that you need to be from the beach. But look, Jonathan, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your sort of background, your education, where did your entrepreneurial spirit come from? You know, sort of take us on the journey going from there and then lead us into when Atos was born.
Yeah, absolutely. My name's Jonathan. As already mentioned, I was born and raised in Düsseldorf in Germany. And in 1998, I went to study. I was always technically interested, but when I left school, I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. So I picked a very common topic, which was mechanical engineering. So I enrolled in a mechanical engineering program at Karlsruhe Institute of Technology at the end of the 90s. I finished those studies, and towards the end, I was introduced to image processing, and that got me interested in computer science. So I switched to the computer science department and did a PhD there. And I was also very interested kind of in the foundations and the theory behind everything. So I, in parallel, while I was doing my PhD in computer science, I did a master's and another master's in applied mathematics. And then for a long time, I wanted to be a scientist. So I went on, actually a scientist in the researcher in the mathematical science. And so I did a couple of postdocs and ended up in California in 2012 and spent 3 years there as a postdoc at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. And this is kind of after 3 years, I decided to switch fields. And, I was kind of close to the ecosystem of Silicon Valley, you know, getting in touch with other founders, other startup founders. And this is kind of, but you know, it's still long before I really founded Atos. But this kind of sparked my interest in entrepreneurship. And I returned to Germany in 2015 to found Atos.
I did think for a minute there that UCLA was the university that they study in Big Bang Theory, but that's Caltech.
Sorry, say that again?
The American TV show, Big Bang Theory.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I just thought it was UCLA, but it's actually Caltech.
It is Caltech. So my former my postdoc advisor, he actually studied and did his PhD at Caltech. So I was there a couple of times. But I do think so. It actually plays at Caltech, but I know people from UCLA who were actually advising the show from the theoretical physics department. It's one of the greatest times of my life there, you know, on UCLA campus, you know, meeting all these, you know, they have a couple of Turing award winners and, you know, Nobel Prize winners. And you don't personally meet all of them, but you know, it's just a very, very interesting atmosphere. Lots of interesting people and always good weather.
Very surreal.
Yeah, very surreal.
Quite an interesting point you mentioned there. I know it's not relevant to the podcast, right? But the degree that you chose when you finished school, right, you choose the degree because it's safe, not because you know what you want to do. Granted, like that was quite some time ago. Even modern day, when I left school, I feel like I didn't know what I want to do. I imagine when I have kids, they'll probably be the same. But what is wrong that we're not, that people or young adults don't get enough time into working life that they'll actually have an idea of what they might enjoy? School system is how old?
It is very, very old, I think, and particularly in Germany. I don't know how it is in other countries, but seems to be very static or very slow compared to corporate or startup life. So it has been the way it is, you know, for decades. And I'm certainly, you know, now I have three kids of my own. They're not yet going to school. So the oldest is 5 years old now. But, you know, I'm pretty sure that, you know, a lot could be changed in German curricula, at least. So, yeah. But I don't think it's a drawback, right? So it's, you kind of have an idea what you want to do. I mean, it's, I also wanted to be a musician, because, you know, like as a hobby, I'm playing music. And, but, you know, I knew, well, I have to make a living sometime. And chances, even if you're good at music, chances you're making it that business, very slim. So, you know, but I was also interested in technology and engineering. And so mechanical engineering is engineering, and it brought me where I got. And now I think, you know, I'm 100% happy with what I'm doing. So I wouldn't have chosen the different path.
Yeah. No, I just always think, for me, if I knew what software development was and software engineering was, maybe at 16, 17, 18, I would have been like, I want to get into it. I actually, we're the only family. The very, very strange, again, comes down to my schooling, comes down to my family circles. Everyone in my family is trained people. So I'm also the fourth non-trained person of males in my family. So that's unique in itself. But personally, for me, I just feel that if there was maybe more practical lessons where still people might have an idea. For me, I always just thought my life existed. Yeah, I was 18 years old and I just thought it existed. Seems very naive now, but that was just part of what it was like for me. But you went to Düsseldorf.
Yes.
Rathaus.
Yeah.
Where did the idea come from? Right? You left UCLA. You left UCLA in December. Looks like Rathaus was about since January.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Well, no, it seems like it, but it wasn't. So it was actually quite a zigzag path before kind of Rathaus, the way, you know, that it exists today, was conceived. So initially, my former, I was planning to do something completely different with Rathaus, actually. So there was a proposal from my postdoc advisor at UCLA to start a company together with a very, very large corporation operating in the fashion business in the field of augmented reality. So computer vision, augmented reality.
You would have been super early with that. Companies have only really started
So that never materialized. So we founded Vatos, but it never took off because of the corporation. They were withdrawing from the whole plan. And then I spent a couple of years, I wanted to stay self-employed. I enjoyed that very much while being a researcher, just being free, to think and do, not whatever I want, but of course there's always constraints. And so I started doing freelance jobs just by myself in the industrial domain. So what I did was help customers reconfigure their industrial robots more easily. By simple technique called parametrization. So there's robots do there's so many processes out there that you could automate in manufacturing, and each process is more or less unique, and that's what makes automation so difficult. What is even more difficult is when you have one machine, one line, one production line is manufacturing multiple products on one and the same line. And it's difficult because kind of the robot and the machine has to adjust to the properties of the new product that you're manufacturing. And so, I worked with businesses that needed that flexibility, that were manufacturing not one. So robotics has been around for a long time, right? So in the automotive industry, the way that works is they'll set up the line once, and then they manufacture 20, 30, 40, 100,000 cars over a time span of let's say 2 or 3 years or the lifetime of the actual model. But now we see small businesses venturing into automation that want to manufacture 2 or 3 or maybe 20 different products and switching on a day-to-day basis. So that's what I helped them with. But in terms of configuration, so configuring their robotic systems. And so this is where the idea emerged, making vision, computer vision, which plays a vital role in the industrial domain, making that flexible. Also vision, computer vision. So that's what we're doing now at Vatos, computer vision for robotics. So making the robot see, outfitting it with a camera and interpreting the contents of the images. So that has been around for 20 years also. So since the 90s at least. But it's still very, as the school system, it's very static, so very inflexible. And so this is, while I was working as a freelancer, this is where the idea emerged, combining what I learned at UCLA in my academic career, which was in computer vision, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and transporting that to, right, combining that with the problem of inflexibility and automation. This is where the idea of was conceived, or the problem was identified that we're working on still today at Vatos. And then in 2000, just to finally answer your question, in 2000, so I went around. I was by myself still, so there was nobody else. I was unfortunately back then I was a single founder. I'm not anymore today. I went around and I said, this is it's really hard to bootstrap that kind of business. There's like a high, technological debt. There's a high risk involved in developing such a system. So I definitely need funding. So I went around by myself, and obviously it didn't work with institutional investors. And we did an angel round in early 2019, in January 2019. And that's kind of really the starting point of Vatos as we know it today. So started with an angel round. We also had a very generous research grant from the European Union, and that combined enabled me to kind of build up a small team. So this is kind of the story of how Vatos was founded, like the Vatos that we know today.
A lot. One of them you mentioned is the cost of introducing a software, very expensive, big overhead. You needed money. You see a lot more startups now who are kind of like they have like a freemium sort of service. And you know, I know it's not, it might not be possible from you, but I guess you can see a lot of people that are now moving into it have that real product mindset, and they come in with what's called like product-led growth. And so that you can actually come in and look, you might get a couple of subscribers for $50 a month. It's only $50, but if you have 100 of those, you can then start to sign up sales, get more, and it's better to have them help with overhead, right? And it always looks really nice. Hey, DC, Mr. DC, I need an extra $800K, and whatever it might be. But I've got some money already. If this is what's happening, I think we can 300x this 1K a month I'm getting, right? We can do something here. Always a lot more common that's becoming now. I don't know if that's because of like stuff like Fortnite, a massively successful example of it. And then you see a lot of open software that are now doing it. They give it to like the engineers. But if the company wants it, boom, here's enterprise, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing you mentioned, quite interested on that one, you mentioned you're not a sole founder anymore. Talk to me why. Talk to me, what was the evaluation? What skills were you looking to bring in another founder? And what was going through your mind then?
Well, maybe I can comment on what you said earlier first. So it's just to put things in perspective. So we're really special compared to other, you know, high growth startups. We're not a high growth startup, but that's the reason. So it's really the kind of the ecosystem in which we operate. So this product led growth, that's exactly kind of the problem we're trying to solve, is get to a point of product led growth. It's not that easy in the industrial domain. So in automation or in manufacturing. First of all, because the industry is very conservative. And second of all, systems are very complex. So we're only contributing one piece in a big machinery, which is the vision part. So there's the robot, there's the machine. And so, you know, we're a part of something much bigger. And it's, you know, it's not like integrating it is not as easy as, you know, subscribing to something on the internet, right? Getting an account, getting a free account and then upgrading it. It's hardware is involved. We don't do the hardware. So it's really, really much easier. So that's exactly what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to make integrating vision into industrial automation systems as scalable as possible. It will never be as scalable as, you know, the companies that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And regarding my co-founder, so yes, I was a single founder, and I knew that this is not very common, and now I know why. So it's really, really good to have a co-founder. So I onboarded my co-founder. So he joined the company just two years ago. And so he's the sales guy, I'm the technical guy. And I, you know, before he joined, I was wearing all the hats. I had to do the fundraising, the management, everything. So the cleanup in the office. It's really great if everybody can focus on, you know, I think it's fundamental that everybody can focus on what they can do best, right? So I'm not a businessman by training, and I'm also not, my talents are not in that, I'm not very talented in that domain. So it's very good to have somebody who can fill that role, you know, from his skills. But it's really hard to find a co-founder, and I tried other people and it didn't work out. So I think it's really hard to find somebody you can trust, right? So you'll need 100% mutual trust, more than that. So I'm really glad I found that person. You spend more time with the person you talk, even more than with your spouse sometimes on some days. So
you've had a really good benefit of it. There's a good benefit of it to you is that a lot of people, when they're founding a team, they generally found that they all have the same skills. You know, they come in together as buddies from school, from work, whatever it might be. you have the option to come in. Yeah, here's my business. We're going about year and a half, 2 years. Do you know what I really don't like? I really don't like the business stuff. I especially don't like sales. My person who I choose to join me on this venture is going to do the stuff that I don't like. Or not even that I don't like. I'm just not going to do that, right? Because if you can, as I said, you can replace yourself with someone better than you, take the opportunity every time and stick to what you're good at, you know, and that's one-on-one. And you've had an opportunity to evaluate it, where a lot of people have to come in and, like you, wearing all the hats. But they're also like you, that they have all the tech skills, and they still, one still has to stay tech, one has to go customer, one has to go finance.
Plus, it's it's just a question of bare timing, right? So it's everything just takes twice as long. You will only be successful in building the company if you manage the product, you build a good product, from a technical perspective. But you market the product. So, I'm only one person and the day has 24 hours. I also have, as I said, I have family. It's I simply cannot work 90 hours a week. I'm also old. So it would be would have been a different story if I had been 25. Like I'm almost 44 now.
25, single and no intentions of
exactly
having a relationship.
Exactly. No, but so this is one of the things that I've learned over the past years. So I heard this saying once. It said you always overestimate what you can do in 2 years, but this is the good part, you underestimate what you can do in five. So definitely things are taking much longer than I expected.
Yeah.
And they would have taken even longer had I been on my own. So it's not just about not wanting to do something and not being good, but it's like, there's this amount of work that needs to be done. If I do it by myself, like from a leadership perspective, then it's just going to take twice as long.
What was the emotional tank? All these multiple roles are doing on yourself. And when I say emotional tank, I mean like doing the sales that you weren't particularly good at. If you had to focus on sales, I don't know, for a whole week, how did you feel after that? Brain, do you feel like you are more stressed in that week than ever?
Well, naturally, things that, it's kind of a chicken egg problem, right? So you're not good at the things you don't like to do, or you don't like the things that you're not good at. So that's the question here. But there's so many things even today that just need to get done that, that are not that fulfilling, right? that's not any different, but they just have to get done, right? So you just have to get the job done, and then you still feel good that, it makes me feel good if I get a job done that, I've been trying to avoid for some time. Except for that, you cannot avoid sales, or you cannot avoid, hiring, building a team. And so there's things that just need to get done. I'm much more efficient today and enjoying it much more overall. Hmm. If I can, focus on what I'm best at, But it never, to answer your question, it never, it was not a showstopper. It never drained me long term or... just seeing the, it needs to get done.
Yeah. Tell me that I'm intrigued by this future CTO. We spoke about it briefly. What is it? What does it do? What's the group all about?
Oh, well, so this is actually, a group of people from, I would say exclusively Germany. We kind of meet once or twice every year and, because exchange ideas, best practices, experiences. So, it's just a get together, an evening of course, in front of an audience of aspiring CTOs, founders, everybody who's interested in. So this is a meeting that's held annually or sometimes biannually in Düsseldorf. And yeah, so it's, you know, it's a great, it's kind of like a conference sort of thing. It's in fact it was held yesterday evening, but I couldn't attend because I was away. Kind of
no
a pity.
Way. No way.
Yeah.
But that's good. That's good. So I mean, look, with this, I wanted to ask you some topics that I would expect, you know, to come up on, like the future CTO from, as I mentioned, from teams, from leadership. But I guess fundamentally, starting off with you, how do you organize yourself? You know, you've mentioned it, family mandatory. Believe, look, you're balancing now between founder, being on holidays, being a family man, being a podcast guest. So look, there's a lot of stuff to do it. And there's a lot of things that you have to manage, lots of places to spend. This is after you've got someone doing the sales, but yeah. How do you organize yourself? How do you set yourself up for success?
Well, nothing new, I guess. So, like what many other people do as well. So, I'm relying very much on, you know, tools. The most important thing being my calendar that I can share. That I can share with people. So I have a private calendar, of course. My wife needs to know when I'm, you know, when I'm gone, when I'm visiting a customer.
I'll give you a really fun one. I have a third calendar with my girlfriend. So she can put in the things that I have to be to, so I know what I can say no to in the future.
Same here. Well, yeah, of course. So calendar for myself, and then of course a shared calendar with a private shared calendar. Shared calendar with co-founders, employees, the team, of course. So so this is for, you know, regulating your time. But I also reserve time for, you know, for planning and contemplation, and then the tools that I use to order my thoughts. And just do the planning. So I think planning is an essential part of my role at Batos. Planning, yeah. Like trying to look ahead and predict. And as I just mentioned earlier, it's a really hard problem, you know, planning ahead. When I said it's you overestimate what you can do in 2 years, but sometimes you tend to underestimate what you can do in 5 years. It always takes longer. So that's also a question of planning. So I think planning is really important. And when I do planning, you know, of course, I take notes digitally, and you know, I use a Trello board just to, you know,
Are you inside? Are you outside? Are you going walking? Do you have, I don't know, a tablet in one hand going around the field?
Well, I never, it's good you mentioned that. So I never, let's say, step out during the workday and say, okay, I'm going to go running and think. But I actually think I should do that because I know from the weekends and from my time off, the best ideas, 99.9%. I have when I go running.
They come flooding in, right? Your energy levels. I mean,
yes.
You go running at lunchtime, your energy levels are great, you work great, and then you come back. Yep. Instead of finishing the day, you're not like, oh, I'm so tired. You're like, hey, honey, you need to have the dinner.
Well, I think I should allow myself to do this during the day.
Yeah.
So as I said, you know, I have a family, I have a business, and, you know, then there's a bit of remaining time that, you know, I spend, you know, getting active, you know, doing something, running, for example. And that's very limited, but it's actually, you could combine it, but I'm not allowing myself to do this during the week. Just because, you know, it's like, there's Slack communication all day long, right? With the team and with my co-founder and customers also. So it's like, I would think that I missed something important, you know, while I'm gone for an hour or so.
Yeah.
But I do it, you know, like my planning, I do a lot of that during the weekends when I go out and running. And it's really the best times. So you have kind of the best ideas. Your head is clear. I don't know why, but it's guaranteed. I go running. I think about work. But things just start to order in my head that were kind of in a big pile or a mess, you know.
If I do this, I'll get why. And then you start trying to form a structure of the process.
Exactly.
Yeah. I get it. Quite similar to myself. You know, people just start getting these calendar invites on a Sunday about how the week's going to set up.
Yep. So calendar, you know, just I sit down, you know, once I have reached a, you know, kind of a result after running, for example, and then, you know, I write things down and maybe reorganize them in a board, in a Trello board or in Google Keep. And yeah, that's it. That's kind of my main tools. Very heterogeneous, but it works well for me.
Talk about something that I will gather comes up quite a lot with new CTOs, aspiring CTOs, or even just young companies, interview process.
Mm-hmm.
What was the biggest difference between, let's say, just interviewing people or then having like a purpose-driven interview where you had a physical process behind it, you had a scoring system, those methods? Did you ever make that change, and what was the differences when you processed?
Well, that's a good question. So we had to, and we did put a process behind it immediately. You know, I never hired before I raised funds in 2019. So as I mentioned earlier, so we did an angel round. I was not by myself. I had a different co-founder partner back then. So it was actually two of us. But we had this money from, you know, like the angel round, but also from the research grant. And we, you know, we could easily build a team of three or four people. And it was really, really difficult in the beginning, interestingly. So we couldn't find anybody. So it was really, really difficult. And interestingly, that turned around completely. So, but we had to put a process in place for two reasons. First of all, the resource was scarce. You know, there was not a lot of people we could interview. So we need to be, you know, we needed to be very thorough. And then second of all, I think, you know, what I've learned by now and you know, it's a common wisdom, but it's like you couldn't repeat that enough, is choose your partners wisely. So like having a good team in every respect, technically, socially, this is one of our big strengths. So we were very, very meticulous about hiring. And so we are currently, so it's me, my co-founder, and we have four technical team members. And they've been around since the beginning. So there has been practically no fluctuation. And I'm a bit proud of that, right? It's very important. That's one of the biggest assets, and we have a really well-functioning team. So yes, we did put this process in place very, very early on. Now I guess you're interested in how that process looked. I hope I can recollect, because I haven't hired anybody in some time, and I hope to hire again very soon. I think we had a three-stage process. So we were, you know, of course, collecting all the applications, screening the applications, and then my co-founder would have an initial conversation with those candidates that we were interested in, and then we had a technical a coding interview over the phone. So a mixture of a technical interview and then a coding interview, actually with live coding. Like I have been through it. I've done this at Google and Apple, and So we actually did that as well. Because we needed somebody, you know, we need people with, you know, kind of basic technical skills, knowledge, but we also, you know, we needed to build a software product. So we needed coding skills. And then we invited people to the office, you know, meeting them, going to lunch with them, and then we would make the final decision. So that's kind of the process that we went through.
You know what? I like the fact that it's also relatively simple. It doesn't have to be, you mentioned Google, it doesn't have to be 7 or 8 steps, right? You're also in a position where you want to attract people, not have them be like, oh, I'm not doing 7 interviews. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Like, unfortunately, and look, if anyone's listening to this and they do have a 5-plus-stage interview,
highly recommend
you reconsider that. You might think you're putting candidates through the process, through their drill, but unless you're Google, candidates don't think you have a right to do it. You know, they won't do it. Amazon, these companies have earned their stripes to demand that as an entry bar. If you're a new business, you can't make those demands, unfortunately.
And I tell you what, you know, so intuition, so with me personally, played a major role. So I'm not very esoteric, but really, you have to have some form of gut feeling. So, you know, like the technical skills, you can, you know, you can test, right? So you can put a check mark and say, well, you know, so this is what I want. And, but then, like, intuition played a great role, at least for me. So, you know, I would say, okay, this is, you know, after meeting somebody in person, so this was really important to me, seeing somebody in person, having a conversation, you know, face-to-face, having, you know, lunch together. Now I would say that's, so team fit. It's so incredibly important, kind of mindset and we also knew what we were looking for. So I wasn't looking for specialists because we're a small group, and so I was looking for generalists. I'm a generalist myself. So actually, we have these two pillars in our team. You know, there's the computer vision team. These are kind of, they're doing algorithms. So really, they're development algorithms, and then we cast those algorithms into a stack, you know, kind of a Kubernetes stack. So then we have the other half of the team is the, you know, like developers. So really, you know, they're writing code all they do, but they don't really work algorithmically, and that already makes it very interdisciplinary. And you know, everybody also, like I did, has to be able to wear, to some extent, of course, every hat.
Yeah.
So I need people, you know, I have one developer who's also a trained kind of electrician. So we have a project where the robot connects to the device. We really have to parse the signals, you know, the binary signal from, you know, voltage from a cable. So I'm glad I have this guy. So I'm not versed in that myself. So he can do it. So that was really, really important to us to have a, you know, kind of a diverse group of generalists rather than specialists, because the specialist I can't reuse, right? Yeah. So I'm really, and it's, we're in a very dynamic environment, and you know, kind of the tasks, they change on a day-to-day basis.
Good shout out there. Good that you have a team that's open and willing to do that. I wanted to help because you've hired 4 people. They've all stuck around for what is a lot longer than the average expectancy of any employee, right? I think the average at the moment is 13 months in tech. So, you know.
Oh, really? Okay.
You're talking, you 3x that. To me, that comes down to, we've spoke about interview process. It comes down to, you know, selection, but then there's elements of it that are up to you. Which is management. You know, what are your management principles that you do? And I mean, you can talk about performance management, how you're upskilling them, how you're keeping them engaged. But what would you say your management principles that you learn to the team? Not to say that, like, you know, you're a principal of a school, but I guess it's kind of like your standard operating model of management.
Well, let me try to kind of give you the big picture to lay it out.
Might be easier.
So it's, yeah, we are in a very, I breathe a very agile spirit, right? So we have there is a goal, right? So we're developing a product. But the way to get there is unclear. We're not making this big plan that we execute, but we're, to some extent, we're operating in an agile or a myopic fashion. And so my job as the CTO is to, I have the goal, I see the steps to take to get to the goal ASAP. So, and that kind of amounts to work packages. So I'm the one who I'm responsible. I'm the captain of the ship. So I see, where's our destination? And, I know what steps I have to plan, the next steps that will ultimately get us to that goal as fast as possible. So that's kind of my role. And my first job is, getting those packages, those steps, and then what I'll do is the second task for me is to distribute. As I said, I have a very diverse team. So many people can do many things. So I have to make sure that that's also part of planning. Right. So increasing the efficiency, who does what? So overall, we're done as soon as possible. So distributing the workloads, then talking to the employee, explaining the work package, having discussion, discussing options of processing the package. There's always different solutions to a problem, a sub problem. And then, of course, as you said. Monitoring. I think you're dropping out. Okay. So ultimately, then, as you mentioned, monitoring whether the package has been, kind of the work package has been processed successfully and in time. And this is kind of the overall process, kind of the big picture of my my management style or the way that we operate at Batos.
So yeah, do you have anything that you would say you do particularly well to keep people engaged? Right, you've got people there close to 4 years. 50% of people there almost 4 years. Is it the work you think it's the fact that they're getting cross-trained with two different sort of disciplines, right? The software guys will learn the computer vision guys will learn software. It's just an outrageous learning environment, right? And you're hiring tech people.
Absolutely. I think that is the reason. So what I've learned is that the most important thing is not money in a job. Of course, we have incentives. We have a virtual stock option plan, things like that, standard things. But purpose beats that by far. So purpose is one of the most important motivations for the people that I work with. So purpose, right. in terms of they'll see, they understand the idea of building this product, and they support that. They can share that vision with me. So that's number one. That makes up a huge part of the motivation. The second one, of course, is, we're a group of nice people. Everybody likes each other just because we do have team fit, despite the corona pandemic, right? So we were in the office. We started off as a team beginning of that phase, and then came COVID, and everybody started working remotely, and, largely still everybody does. And then third is what you mentioned. So I think it's because we have generalists, and I require everybody to, kind of learn the other things. So we don't have time, and I don't upskill people in some official ways that I send them to a training or anything. They learn, I think, so much on the job. So I'm the one who facilitates, right? So I I learned by myself and, during my academic career, I'm seeing, by my experience. Now I'm kind of versed in both worlds. And I introduced them to the other world, so the development world and the computer vision world and vice versa. And that is, I think that's also a large part of the motivation is that the folks that I have, that I work with, they're like eager to learn and they see the value of that. So, and that's kind of the different components of what motivates them. But it's not money, it's really what they work on, that they're, you know, they're able to learn, but it's not for everybody, right? So there's people who say, you know, I don't want to take responsibility. You know, I want to do one thing that I know well and do this 8 hours a day, and I'm happy with that. I'm most happy with that, but not the people that I work with.
So what about the people that do take on that responsibility and it's the first time doing it? How do you create an environment for them to allow them to fail? Ultimately, allowing them to fail means, yeah, look, you're not fired if you mess this up. But also, if they get it wrong, they'll never make that mistake again. Or if they get it right the first time, hey, great, look, everyone's a winner.
Well, of course, you know, failure is a part part of our lives, of the job. It's totally natural. I make mistakes. My employees make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. But yeah, I mean, of course, we do have now. Let's talk about tooling again, or tools and processes. Of course, we have processes in place to, you know, reduce the risk of error or mistakes. Mm-hmm. Our problem is as a startup, I think, is we have to move fast, but we cannot afford to have too much technical debt and to make mistakes, grave mistakes. And you have to balance that out, right? So you could sit there and overthink something for a very long time to make sure you got it 100% right. And but then you're dead, right? So because you're not fast enough. I mean, dead in terms of business. And so this is really kind of also my part of the job. And so I do allow to make mistakes, not just my employees, also I allow myself to make mistakes. But to safeguard this process, of course, we're using, you know, we're following best practices. We have, you know, like unit testing pipelines, integrate auto-alts, everything is automated. Unit testing, integration testing pipelines. We have staging environments where we test our software. It's really important, right? So we're in the robotics domain. It's not, if we make a mistake, then the robot will have a collision. So mistakes are potentially fatal, or, you know, they'll incur cost, like damage, a lot, you know, right? So if the, you know, we build a vision system that tells the robot how to pick something out of a box. So, and not to collide with the side of the box. So our systems, they have to be 100% safe, secure. So, you know, we have all these tools in place to make sure to guarantee sufficient software quality. But then also we work a lot. So when we, you know, when we get really to the bottom of that, right? So when we devise our algorithms, we also make sure that there's multiple layers of safety. Like in, you know, airline industry, right? So when you build an airplane, there's always two colors, redundancy, there's different layers of self-safety. And we have similar requirements or similar methodologies for the industrial domain. It's probably not as bad if a robot, you know, hits a box and is broken as when an airplane crashes. But, you know, we kind of use those methodologies as well in developing our software.
Right. You also spoke about passion and vision. Just a personal interest here. How often do you relay the vision back to the team? Is it weekly, bi-monthly, monthly? Do you have I know some people say we do it at the start of the week, the midweek, the end of the week. Here's our goal. Here's our vision. Here's why we're all here, right?
Very, very good question. So actually weekly.
Yeah.
So I have one-on-one meetings where with everybody on a weekly basis, where we talk about, you know, work packages, discuss solutions. So I'm not a fan of having like a big meeting, and, you know, and talking about technical things in that meeting with everybody, because when you talk about a detail, the rest is boring because it doesn't concern them. I remember that back in my PhD, you know, we had this meeting with all PhD students, 10 PhD students, and the meeting would go as follows. The professor would say, hey, you know, what is up? What is new? What happened last week? To everybody. So the meeting would be like 3 hours. Okay. And then one person was speaking and 9 other people were falling asleep, right? So because they didn't understand what was going on. So I'm not a big fan of, you know, talking about the very, the smallest detail in a group of engineers. So I try to avoid that, but we do have a weekly get together, kind of like a town hall meeting. And this is where kind of vision, the big picture is really in focus. And I think it's super important and part of the motivation again, you know, that people are aware of what is the goal. What am I working on, right? So because all of them are just working on a part of the whole thing. You know, they're working on a wheel and the other one is working on the engine. The other one is working, but you know, together we're building a car and I think they should be aware of that. It's a large part of the motivation of the team. So we do it on a weekly basis, actually. But apart from that, you know, we discuss, you know, administrative things and, but I try to avoid having long technical discussions where that doesn't concern everybody in the meeting.
Ready for the quick fire questions, Jonathan?
Yes, absolutely.
Nice and easy one. Is there content, books, podcasts that you listen to that you would recommend to someone else?
Well, I do, you know, I'm here with you and I really enjoy it and I'm contributing to a podcast now, but I have to be really honest. I have no recommendations. I don't really get the time to listen to podcasts. And as I said, I have a young family and then it's really family, then the core work, and then maybe a bit of sports during the weekend. You know, this is kind of fills my week. I'm currently, but it's not a business book, still inspirational. So I'm reading right now, the first time in months, I'm reading a book by Carl Sagan. Who I admire very much.
It helps. I pan music when I go running. I listen to podcasts when I run
Okay.
Doesn't get the heart rate going as much, but I found it more interesting, weirdly enough.
Well, that's actually a good idea, but it's been, you know, running with music or, you know, headphones was just bothering me. And then, as I said, you know, it's I can either listen or think, and it's so productive when I'm not listening. So not listening to anything, but I can just think while I'm running.
Yeah.
That I do prefer that.
And what are your three non-negotiables when it comes to being an entrepreneur, leadership? It can be non-negotiables you set yourself or you set your business.
Well, I think I mentioned those. It's, for me as a CTO, the most important trait is being able to plan, like planning, you know, seeing where the whole ship goes, the destination, and then, you know, planning the steps. And you still, you know, you will always underestimate the time that you need to get somewhere. So really planning is, as the CTO, I think one of the most important skills. And then, of course, you know, kind of converting that plan into bringing that into action, you know, it's motivating the team to as efficiently as possible work through the plan that you've worked out. And last, you said three,
yeah.
Two or three. So the last thing that I think is very important, I mean, it affects the team as well as customers and investors. So communication, I think communication skills are super important. So being able to talk to customers, to understand their requirements, but also to be able to say no, right? I couldn't do that really well when I started. So when I was still by myself.
No one does.
Yeah.
Excitement takes over. You think you can do it all.
Exactly. So kind of balancing between, you know, you need this job really desperately, so you better listen, and then, you know, taking jobs that just deviate you from your path and your original goal. So, but communication. So that's a communication with customers, with your employees, investors also, is I think a very, very important skill that you need to have as a founder.
If you could do it all again, what would you do different?
I think there's not a lot I would do differently, but I would be more careful with the choice of the partners. So without, you know, wanting to go in too much detail, but this is kind of, I can't stress this enough, that wisdom is true. Choose your partners wisely. And some decisions are really hard to revert. And it's you have to be very, very picky with the people that you work with. And I have made mistakes in that regard. And those things, I would give myself more time in picking partners and collaborators. So that I would have done differently. And the other thing, not be as optimistic as I was about timing.
Good one.
Things always take longer than you expect. That is also true. I've learned that.
That does us for time, Jonathan. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
I have to thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
That concludes another enlightening episode of the Leadership Labs podcast. If you found today's episode thought-provoking and informative, be sure to subscribe to the Leadership Labs on your preferred podcast platform or on YouTube. Thank you once again for joining us on this journey through the Leadership Labs. Until next time.